criminalizing women and girls who fight back against domestic and family violence. So while Bleacha may be an outlier in the fact that not many young teenagers are charged with killing their abusive parents, we also don't know how many mothers or adult women are charged with killing their abusive spouses or husbands. In New York State, there's a call for Governor Cuomo to grant clemency to domestic violence survivors behind bars. And Governor Brown has done this in California. It is his last year in office. Even before his last year in office, he started looking at clemency for domestic violence survivors. People are calling on Governor Cuomo to do the same thing.
Well, we'll leave it there. Victoria Law, freelance journalist, will link to your piece, Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women. That is her book, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Nat Needham. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
It's 5 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News.
Hi, this is John Chuck, host of The Beloved Community, every second Friday at 9 a.m. on KBOO. Right after Positively Revolting. This Friday, February 9th, I speak with Glenn Montgomery. He's the executive director of the Vision Action Network of Washington County. The mission of the Vision Action Network is to engage stakeholders across sectors to collaboratively address critical issues in Washington County. And some of those issues we will discuss include income inequality, cultural diversity, and housing and houselessness. I will take your phone calls as we work together to build the beloved community. This Friday, February 9th at 9 a.m. on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland performance of Soliloquists of Sound and Marv Ellis and We Try on Friday, February 9th at Mississippi Studios in Portland. This show is a co-headlined evening of psychedelic and funky conscious hip-hop from Florida and Portland. Their intention for this show is to help unify communities and to raise consciousness towards social and political issues here in the U.S. and around the world. Again, that's Soliloquists of Sound and Marv Ellis and We Tribe on Friday, February 9th at Mississippi Studios, 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Council of the Village of Hope protested at the Portland City Council meeting this morning.
The Senate today reached a two-year, $400 billion budget agreement to fund the government beyond tomorrow.
And President Trump has ordered a military parade in Washington to honor himself.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 7th, 2018. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Today, KBOO News poet Dan Raphael brings you the news that most sources won't.
I'm here to give the news that things are trickier, more perilous than we expected. We're on the path to fascism, but it's not a path. It's an eroding cliff. It's a lot of eroding expectations, promises, common sense. When Trump says those who don't applaud him are committing treason, this is one time he's not lying. Since he can't fire his critics, he wants them silent, arrested, deported, or kept from coming here in the first place. So what do we do? As he convinces enough people with too many guns he's a victim and must be defended so he will make us great again? What do we do? They've been working on this coup for over 40 years, so think about it. Talk to others. Open your heart. Have community. Resist the hate. Resist despair. They can start a war. They can cancel an election. They can set us against each other while they decide which of their homes to visit next. What do we do? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Facing accusations of sexual misconduct, Charles McGee, co-founder and executive director of the Black Parent Initiative, has been placed on administrative leave. McGee also ended his campaign for the open seat on the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. The current Willamette Week has an investigative report on claims by Erica Nato Campbell of assault by McGee and Aubrey Dixon on May 10, 2012. Nato Campbell, granddaughter of Portland developer Bill Nato, did not report the incident before now. I always told myself I would come forward if Charles ever ran for office, she said. Dixon, a local banking executive, resigned his position as chairman of the state's Housing Stability Council Monday. The Black Parent Initiative, founded 12 years ago, has contracts with Multnomah County, Portland Public Schools, and other agencies to provide services to children and families.
Crows, what can you do about them? You can't poison or shoot them. You shoot them away and they come right back, assuming you want to get rid of them, congregating downtown in flocks numbering in the thousands. You can pressure wash their poo off the sidewalk, and the next day there's more and the noise that hundreds can make. Bring in the hawks, specifically Clive and two other Harris hawks trained by Court Clayton, owner of Integrated Avian Solutions, a Portland-based company that provides raptors to vineyards, dumps, and business districts. The hawks wearing GPS tracking devices are trained to not kill the crows, but are rewarded for how many they scare away. The crows don't know about the hawks' training, so take flight as soon as they spot airborne predators. Last week, 10 crows were found dead in northeast Portland, poisoned.
A recent Oregon State audit found that the Oregon Department of Human Services Child Welfare System was severely failing multiple initiatives that it pledged to remedy within the last decade. The audit also found DHS Child Welfare was not adequately meeting foster care needs for at-risk children, with caseworkers taking children to their homes to care for them or booking them into hotels. Democrats in the Oregon legislature are not coming up with any immediate plans to address the child welfare program. Senate Democrats say they approved a $30 million budget increase last year that was in part meant to increase pay for foster parents. Democrat legislators also say the pressure they've put on agency bureaucrats recently has helped make recent improvements to the program. Representative Newt Bueller, a Republican from Bend, who may be running against Kate Brown in the fall gubernatorial election, issued a call Monday for the legislature to find another $50 million in 2018 to expedite the response to the audit findings. Bueller disagreed with a statement by Secretary of State Dennis Richardson, a fellow Republican and the elected official behind the audit, that all Oregonians must work together to solve the problem, not just the governor or legislature. He said, quote, "If this isn't a problem for the governor or legislature to fix, why are we even here? Our job is to lead, and if we don't, why are we even meeting the next 35 days?
Senate Democrats continue to defend their work to improve foster care, referring to Governor Kate Brown as being supportive but not instrumental in their efforts. But Oregon's DHS child welfare program has been riddled with scandal. Last May, Mary Holden Ayala, the former director of the now-closed foster care home Give Us This Day, was indicted on several felonies that included theft, a false tax return, money laundering, criminal money transactions, and tax evasion. Holden's agency received about $1.5 million a year from the Oregon Department of Human Services. The recent state audit found that DHS has not kept up on legal mandates designed to keep Oregon's children safe, maintains poor and disorganized management, and has not made substantive changes to its structure in order to improve services. It spent $20 million on a new system to help contain cases and their sensitive information, but auditors found that caseworkers were still using Post-it notes the majority of the time to record data. Last year, DHS Child Welfare Directors Clyde Sakey and Lena Almusini resigned from the program after a review found that in 100 cases, children were not actually safe in their homes. Current Director Marilyn Jones issued a statement in response to the audit implying that DHS has achieved some success. She said, "Our caseworkers and supervisors are committed and resilient and are helping children safe and reunite with their families when possible or to be adopted if that is the best option." In 2017, a total of 2,134 kids left foster care to be reunited with families. 673 were adopted. We should celebrate our successes even as we acknowledge our problems.
The Council of the Village of Hope protested at the Portland City Council meeting this morning. A community built by houseless folks living on public land, the village was demolished by Portland police on February 2nd, accompanied by a reprimand from Mayor and Police Commissioner Ted Wheeler. Here's the testimony from the Village of Hope, conducted by houseless rights advocate Star Stauffer.
I'm here to talk about the Village of Hope, and as you can see, the Village of Hope is standing right behind me. They have faces, they have names, they are human beings. And they don't understand why they have been swept from a place that was so far from where it could even bother anybody else, with no solution of where they're supposed to go. But I didn't want to speak on behalf of them, but rather I wanted to speak using the words that they had asked me to say. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. This is the Council of the Village of Hope. They've already formed their own government and system of accountability within their community. They would like and say that they need a small space of their own. It is only right that they have a place to take care of and to sleep. They wanted it mentioned that homeless folks take up space, so they will be occupying public land. The question is whether or not they will do so to the city's benefit or the city's detriment. The Village of Hope provides an opportunity for houseless folks to give back to the community that they live in. They have no way to do that when they're sleeping on a sidewalk, when they're scrambling to find a pallet or a tent or blankets that are dry. They have no way to do that when they're standing in line for shelters that may never open. They have no way to do that while they sit around waiting for you to figure out what affordable housing actually means and enforce that when developers come in and try to take over communities. They have no way to do that while you still have no plan to really tackle the problem of increasing rents. They have no way to do that when they're busy trying to field off all the illnesses that come with being houseless and all the things that make them vulnerable, running from cops, running from other people who would abuse them because of how vulnerable they are. You expect them to pick up their garbage, but you give them no way to live like a human being. And then you call them animals and treat them like animals because they have garbage around or they're sleeping on the sidewalk. But you don't have any other place for them to go. And they don't have the time to wait till 2035, Wheeler. They don't have that. So while you invest over $300,000 in senseless speed signs, you sweep out this village and pay cops to terrorize these communities, you give them no solution. But they have proposed to you a nonviolent and very peaceful solution to the problem of houselessness, at least for the people standing behind me. And you won't allow them to have that. You need to save the Village of Hope and stand behind these people that live in your community. They matter.
Thank you.
That was Star Stauffer in the Village of Hope at this morning's City Council meeting. The protesters exited the council chambers chanting, "We will be back."
The Preserve Coalition, in partnership with nonprofit organization The Geezer Gallery and Regional Arts and Culture Council, are offering a special event for older African Americans to learn more art skills while also documenting and sharing their memories and experiences with soul food at the event, Heart and Soul. KBOO's Zealous Marchant spoke to program coordinator Edeline Francois and Linda Boyce, Preserve Coalition co-chairs, about the special series.
All right. I have on the line Edeline Francois, project coordinator, and Preserve Coalition co-chair Linda Boyce of Preserve. Welcome.
Thank you for having us, Emos.
Totally. So, yeah,
thank you very much.
You bet. So let's talk about this great event coming up, the Heart and Soul event. You want to tell our listeners what that is and why it's so exciting?
Yes. So the Preserve Coalition is debuting our first Art and Soul Food Creative Arts and Writing Project, which is a free six-week course held at the June Key Delta Community Center every Wednesday starting from February 14th to March 21st. We are actively recruiting for this project. And what it is it's a creative arts and writing project that will explore stories from our elder African-American community about soul food, its historical significance, impact on our personal lives, memories, relationships, generational influence, health, and honoring its substantial contribution to American culture and cuisine. This is for older African-Americans 50 and above. There is absolutely no writing or artistic talent required. You will be learning new techniques in creative writing, and also you will have guidance as far as creating a art project that's a 20 by 20 canvas that illuminates your experience around soul food. We also have some prompts that we will be asking you as you share your story. One of them is, what were the smells you remember in your home during the holidays? Who was at your holiday table? And one of the questions that I find dear to heart is, some say that memories are made in grandma's kitchen. So finding your fondest memories around your mother's kitchen or grandmother's kitchen, big mama, whoever, whichever adult figure that was instrumental in cooking in your family, drawing those memories out about that experience, and really illuminating it by using art. So this is what this project is about.
That sounds wonderful. And I understand there's a bit of recruiting going on.
Yes.
You want to fill our listeners in on that?
Absolutely. So we're looking for older African Americans who are 50 years and above, who can commit to a 6-week program like this one every Wednesdays starting February 14th through March 21st. We have two sessions, either morning or afternoon. So morning is 10 to 12. And afternoon is from 1 to 3, so either one of those sessions. If you are interested, please, please, please don't hesitate to call my number, which is 561-543-5213, or you can email me at francoye@ohsu.edu.
That's great. And will this be an ongoing series? I mean, will there be more like this in the future?
Linda, would you like to speak to that?
Sure. We don't expect that this will be continued. This is provided under a special grant from the Regional Arts and Culture Council, which we were, of course, very excited to get some funding for, just a small amount of funding. And I think the Regional Arts and Culture Council was also quite excited to offer this program to a group that they haven't really had much opportunity to serve, which is older African Americans. So it's a one-time grant. We don't really expect it to continue. So we hope that if people are interested, they'll contact us right away so they can sign up and be part of it. Yeah, and just to repeat the contact information, the number is 561-543-5213, and or email to Francois, to Edline at francoie@ohsu.edu.
Well, it sounds like a very special opportunity. And Linda, I was hoping you could also fill in our listeners about what Preserve Coalition is focused on, and tell our folks a little bit about what you're doing.
Sure. The Preserve Coalition is a coalition of service providers, community members, and some researchers from primarily OHSU. And what we're really passionate about is maintaining the physical and especially brain health for older African Americans. And we know that people are so much at risk as they get older for memory loss and other concerns related to brain function. And so what we're really trying to do is offer opportunities for African Americans to really understand the challenges and the issues related to brain health and ways that people can maintain their health. So we've done a number of workshops. We call them talk and taste programs on diabetes and sleep and exercise and various ways in which people can maintain their health. And this program is really our first one where we've gotten into the area of creative arts. But we have always been interested in the creative arts, which we believe is a very important and wonderful way for older people generally to maintain their health and their enthusiasm for being part of the community. So we think this program kind of brings together a lot of what we believe in, which is that creative activity is good for the brain, and an opportunity to serve the community through learning art techniques and telling their story. And the other thing about this program that I think fits with Preserve really well is that everything we do is very Afrocentric. We're very, very interested in doing programs and talking about issues in ways that are very culturally responsive to African Americans. So our talk and taste programs that we've offered and conferences that we've held have all had a very strong Afrocentric focus. And we think this program will do that too.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Thank you for all the work that you're doing. In closing, is there anything of particular importance apart from the Heart and Soul event coming up that you would like listeners to know?
Just that it's starting so soon, so we hope people won't delay.
That's right.
And make the call. And the classes are filling up, so people shouldn't delay, and we hope that we'll be able to accommodate everybody who's interested in it.
Great.
It'll be fun, it'll be exciting, and it'll be a great opportunity for people to share their memories and their experiences with other people, both during the classes, but also there's going to be a reception that will be held at the June Key Center in June. And so people will have a chance to kind of see what's been produced and what's been thought about in terms of this program.
This is Zelo Zelos Marchant for KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a live interview on News from the Boo. At 6, it's Kitchen Table Conversations, followed at 7 by Keeping It Real. Tonight's weather is patchy fog, increasing clouds with a low of 44. Tomorrow has a 30% chance of rain in the afternoon with a high of 55. Today in history, in 1964, the Beatles landed in New York for their first U.S. visit. 2 days later, they appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show. Quote of the day is from Beatle John Lennon. If someone thinks that love and peace is a cliche that must have been left behind in the 60s, that's his problem. Love and peace are eternal.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Last fall, a racial slur was written on a dorm room of two Native American students at Sheridan College. The event led the school to work on improving the experience of tribal students on campus. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
Sheridan College officials recently hosted a roundtable that brought together leaders from both tribes of the Wind River Reservation, the president of the Human Rights Consultancy, representatives from the U.S. Department of Education, and others to discuss race relations. Northern Arapaho Chairman Roy Brown was among them. He says he commends College President Paul Young for taking the event seriously.
It really shows a commitment to making sure that all of their students feel safe and making sure that the culture on Sheridan College is one of inclusivity and that bias against race or other protected classes is not going to be tolerated.
Brown says panelists discussed ideas like opening a Native American center on campus where tribal students can gather, adopting more protective policies, and hiring more Native Americans on campus.
Currently, there are no faculty that are Native American. And so that's something that President Young has acknowledged that Sheridan College can improve on and will take steps to try and diversify their faculty and staff.
Brown says right now, only a few Northern Arapaho students attend Sheridan College, but if more effort was made to welcome them, that could change. The tribe has over 10,000 members, and 40% of those are under the age of 18. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
Indigenous people are among those opposing the more than 1,000-mile U.S.-Canada oil pipeline replacement project by the company Enbridge. As Melinda Tuhus reports, Native groups are concerned about threats to the environment.
The $7 billion Line 3 pipeline would bring 750,000 barrels a day of diluted bitumen from the Alberta tar sands across North Dakota, Minnesota, and Wisconsin to be shipped through Lake Superior. Misty Babineau, a member of the Red Lake Band of Anishinaabe, who works with Honor the Earth, says Native people are concerned about the climate and other environmental effects in both the U.S. and Canada, and Honor the Earth has created a map of the project.
From an Indigenous standpoint, when you take a look at this map, there's an overlay of locations for lakes where wild rice grows on it, and like the highest concentration of these lakes, that is where the route is going. It is also going to be crossing into 1854 and 1855 treaty territory. The reservations that land belongs to have specifically stated and passed their own resolutions at their governmental level stating that they don't want a new pipeline in their territory.
Babineau adds that man camps set up for workers building the pipeline are also among safety concerns. Enbridge needs a certificate of need from the Public Utilities Commission of Minnesota. If that is granted, the commission would then approve a route. Enbridge maintains the replacement project is needed in order to support crude oil production growth. Melinda Tuhus, National Native News.
Advocates are urging for the reauthorization of the special diabetes program for Indians as U.S. lawmakers work on a spending bill. Government funding runs out this week. The National Indian Health Board says it supports a two-year reauthorization of the program, which was in the House Appropriations Committee resolution to fund the government through March 23rd. U.S. New Mexico Senator Tom Udall wrote a letter to leaders in both the House and Senate this week asking for reauthorization, saying grantees are reporting the uncertainty of the program has led to increased staff turnover. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Senate today reached a two-year, $400 billion budget agreement to fund the government beyond tomorrow. The agreement raises spending for the military and for some domestic programs. Also today, Representative Nancy Pelosi spoke for 4 hours in Congress, saying she would oppose any budget bill that didn't reinstate the DACA program, which the Senate budget does not. This weekend, President Trump said he would shut down the government if the new budget doesn't fund his wall and add more immigrant restraints. If a budget agreement, short or long term, is not made by late tomorrow, the federal government will shut down again.
What says leadership and democracy more than a huge military parade, soldiers marching, tanks rumbling, jets screaming overhead? Think North Korea or Stalin's Soviet Union or Hitler's Germany. Well, President Trump, our commander-in-chief, has ordered a military parade in Washington to honor himself. He's also calling for a $716 billion Pentagon budget next month, a 7% raise from last year's request, which has not yet passed Congress. Stephen Miles, director of Win Without War, argued that a parade of the kind that Trump envisions would only signal the president's desire to continue a policy of endless wars like those in Afghanistan and Syria. Neither a date nor an estimate of the parade's cost has yet been released.
Michael Foster, a valve turner who temporarily halted the flow of tar sands oils in TransCanada's Keystone Pipeline in October of 16, was sentenced yesterday in a North Dakota court to 3 years in prison. Unlike the judges in other valve turner trials, Judge Lori Fontaine did not allow Foster to use a necessity defense, arguing his action was necessary to avoid or minimize a harm that was greater than the harm resulting from violating the law. Foster, a mental health counselor from Seattle, faced a maximum penalty of 21 years in prison, but is expected to only serve 1 year and then to be released on probation. "It doesn't matter if I'm sitting in jail," Foster declared after his sentencing. "What matters is stopping the pollution." TransCanada and the state of North Dakota had both pushed for a harsh sentence to deter other climate activists.
Now it's time for Labor History in 2 with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the day gold miners in Cripple Creek, Colorado, walked out on strike. mine owners increased the workday from 8 to 10 hours. They refused to increase workers' pay accordingly. Workers immediately affiliated with the Western Federation of Miners. Local 19 leader John Calderwood demanded a return to the 8-hour day at the previous wage, but the mine owners refused. About 6 weeks into the strike, the larger gold mines imported scabs. Violence soon followed. The El Paso County Sheriff demanded the governor call out the state militia. But Colorado's Governor Davis Waite was a populist. He recalled the troops upon learning that they would be used as strikebreakers. Soon, the mine owners raised their own private army of 100 troops, which grew to over 1,200. By May, miners had armed themselves. They took over a mine in Victor and blew it up when deputies arrived with scabs. Governor Waite ordered the owner's private army disbanded and called the militia out to defend the strikers. Mine owners agreed to return to the 8-hour workday at no loss in pay, but refused to disband their army. They arrested and beat hundreds of miners. The owners finally disbanded the forces when the governor threatened the militia's presence in Victor for a month to keep the scab army immobilized. It was the first and probably only time a state militia was called out in defense of striking workers. According to Eric Loomis, it was arguably labor's biggest win in the Gilded Age. Waite lost the next election, but the victory meant enormous organizing gains for the Western Federation of Miners throughout the Rocky Mountain region.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
The European Court of Justice is raising questions about the rights the British have to European Union citizenship. A case on the issue has been brought to the court by five British nationals. The case could determine whether British nationals living in the European Union will have voting restrictions, restrictions in movement, or grounds to revoke citizenship. The case is one of many in the aftermath of the Brexit ruling.
French Muslim singer Manil Ibtissam has been a voice of hope after winning French audiences on The Voice and performing Arabic and French renditions of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah while wearing a head cover. But in a series of recent scandals involving ambassadors for diversity in Europe, Ibtissam showed a controversial opinion of France, a country with notorious integration problems. In social media activity, Ibtissam alleged that she supported Palestinian propaganda, conspiracy theories, and made claims that the French state, not jihadists, are responsible for terrorism. That last remark, posted by the 23-year-old songwriter in 2016, almost made judges of the French edition of The Voice disqualify her from the competition. A year later, Ibtissam has refused to retract her sentiments going back to 2015 on the French state's responsibility for terrorist attacks. Recently, a Tribune author found that Ibtissam took artistic license with her versions of the song Hallelujah. Translations revealed that successive verses were stripped of the song's original messages of sensual language and sexual allusions, making them more suitable for conservative audiences.
Hunger is still ravaging Muslims, feeling the Myanmar military soldiers who are fleeing the Myanmar military soldiers who are driving them to refugee camps. Reports of soldiers stealing food and agricultural resources continue to pour into news sources. In many cases, soldiers are killing those who attempt to stop them from stealing precious food stores. Rapes, massacres, and complete destruction of villages by the Myanmar military in western Rakhine state has forced out close to 700,000 Rohingya Muslims who are running to Bangladesh. Currently, food supplies become another weapon being used against the shrinking numbers of Rohingya. True accounts of extreme hunger could not be confirmed to news sources, since Myanmar's government does not allow reporters in the northern part of Rakhine State, where most of the Rohingya lived, but a dozen interviews by the Associated Press with the most recent refugees show increasing desperation as the pressure increases in their communities in what UN officials say may be a genocide. The Rohingya Muslims have been persecuted by Myanmar's Buddhist majority for several decades, are in lockdown in their villages and sometimes homes, and are prevented from foraging, fishing, farming, trade, or work. The AP also found that while these restrictions have been in place for some time in that area, the access to food has been incredibly tightened in recent weeks.
And now it's time for a report on climate change for Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Climate change is not simply a matter of cause and effect. It's more like a vicious circle. Thomas Crowther is a professor at ETH Zurich, a university in Switzerland.
Not only are we directly altering the climate, but that process in itself is kicking off these things that are going to actually accelerate the damaging impacts over the rest of the century.
This self-reinforcing cycle is called a feedback loop. For example, warmer temperatures make soil microbes more active. The microbes then release more carbon into the atmosphere, which in turn speeds up global warming, which makes the microbes even more active, and so on.
I just imagine a sort of wheel spiraling out of control.
Melting sea ice is another example. Because ice is white, it reflects sunlight back to outer space, which reduces the heat absorbed by the Earth. But global warming melts the ice, leaving dark ocean water behind. The water then absorbs the sun's heat, which increases global warming, leading to more melting ice. Crowther says it's hard to predict just how much these feedback loops will speed up the pace of global warming, so they represent a worrisome unknown. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Next up, it's the latest news in water health from H2O Radio.
Chevron says if they did it, others did it too. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
In a move that evoked images from a 19th century gold rush, at 6 a.m. last Friday, the Bureau of Land Management opened up parts of southeastern Utah to companies and prospectors so they could start staking mining claims. The areas opened recently lost protection when Trump severely downsized the Bear's Ears and Escalante Grand Staircase Monument designations.
According to Reuters, the process to stake a claim is just like it was 150 years ago. A prospector hammers four poles into the ground, corresponding to the four points of a parcel that can be as big as 20 acres, and attaches a written description of the claim onto one of them. A prospector then has 30 days to record the claim at the local BLM office.
Environmental organizations like the Southeastern Utah Wilderness Alliance are concerned that new mining could cause harm to the area. But right now, with the price of uranium down to about $25 a pound, the economy seems to be dampening interest.
Last week, the Trump administration took action to impose a 2-year delay on a rule defining what bodies of water can be regulated by the EPA and the Corps of Engineers.
While the Obama-era rule is delayed, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt said the agency will work on a new definition of waters of the U.S., or WOTUS, as it's known.
All of this maneuvering was occasioned by the Supreme Court ruling last week, which sent a case challenging Obama's rule back to the lower courts.
Farm Bureau President Zippy Duval said in a statement that farmers value clear water, but they deserve clear rules, too. His view is that the old rule would have treated low spots and ditches on farms just like flowing waters, and that farmers could be penalized simply for plowing a field.
On the other side, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman said his state will sue the administration for threatening to eliminate protections for millions of miles of streams and acres of wetlands.
Joe Devine with the Natural Resources Defense Council called Pruitt's action grossly irresponsible, illegal, and they too will challenge it in court.
And speaking of EPA Administrator Pruitt, he testified before a Senate committee last week, and as was reported by The Intercept, when he was asked a series of yes or no questions, he could not or would not answer.
Senator Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, asked Pruitt a simple question. Is it a good idea for children to handle dangerous pesticides? Rather than answering directly, Pruitt mentioned that a rule about the subject was undergoing review and open to public comment.
Around the world, citizens are suing governments and energy companies for failing to protect them against climate change.
Among about 900 cases worldwide are suits brought by children, including a pending case in Oregon in which kids claim that policies promoting fossil fuels are violating their rights to life, liberty, and property.
The trend is continuing. IRTHA reports that last week some 25 children and adults filed a lawsuit in Bogota, Colombia, demanding a right to a healthy environment free from deforestation and the irreversible impacts of climate change.
Meanwhile, in Colorado last week, the state's high court agreed to decide if the protection of public health and environment must be fulfilled before the state can permit oil and gas drilling.
The case is being pursued mostly by teenagers who proposed that Colorado must use the best available science to determine whether an oil and gas project dangerously affects human health or contributes to climate change.
In the past, the state regulatory agency has said that it must balance oil and gas interests against public health and safety, rather than prioritizing health and climate change.
In related news, Chevron is being sued in California by the cities of San Francisco and Oakland for billions of dollars to pay for seawalls and protections against the effects of climate change.
Last week, the oil giant turned around and sued another major producer, saying that if Chevron has to pay, then so should others.
In a legal move, Chevron brought the Norwegian oil giant Statoil into the case by filing what's known as a third-party complaint. Chevron did not admit that it was liable to the cities, but said that many other sovereign governments that promote fossil fuels must be brought in also.
It was not clear why Chevron chose the Norwegian giant to be the first fossil fuel producer it included in the case. However, it may signal that the same strategy will be used against others.
And finally, to Singapore, where monitoring water quality so that it's safe to drink is a top priority. Typically, testing the country's reservoirs has been done by humans in boats, which is time-consuming and expensive, and limits the response time for officials were there to be an outbreak or contamination.
To address the problem, researchers at the National University of Singapore came up with a new way to track pollution and developed its Smart Water Assessment Network, known as SWAN, like the bird.
But it wasn't just an acronym. The team developed a flock of swan bots, robots designed to putter around reservoirs and collect data in real time about water quality. The high-tech waterfowl roam autonomously but can be commanded remotely to monitor a certain area or bring back water samples to shore for lab analysis.
For onlookers, the bots are an aesthetic addition as they look real. And for the researchers, they're fairly low maintenance. They don't need to be fed, just come back to the bank occasionally to have their batteries recharged.
The hard plastic robot swans have water sampling equipment inside, and although the birds look benign and graceful, the developers say they're sturdy enough to survive a collision with a kayak or small boat.
But the swans aren't the only robots testing water. Last year, a team in Switzerland developed a robotic eel to track pollution in Lake Geneva. So it may not be long before more helpful bots roam rivers, lakes, and even oceans in your area.
If you want to see the Singapore swans, head over to our website at h2oradio.org. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Zelis Marchant. The producer is Kyle Qureshi. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. And you can also find us on Facebook or on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. At 9, it's Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell. News you're not supposed to know. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Between the Covers, Ken Jones talks with Paul Cohen, author of the novel The Glam Shack. And at 11:30, The Film Show. Filmmakers from the Cascade Festival of African Films and the Portland International Film Festival join SW Concert in the studio. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
That's right, it is 5:45 on a Wednesday, which means, once again, it is time for News from the Boo, our weekly roundup of items of interest for folks here at the station and in the listening community. We're joined tonight by Delphine Crescenzo. Del, I have to ask you first of all.
Yes.
Co-station manager or station co-manager?
I'm not co-managing anymore. I'm station manager.
Station manager, yeah. Delphine Crescenzo. All right. Man, that makes it so much easier.
I know, it does. But I do. It's a great opportunity to thank Gil Cardon and Mike Crenshaw, who last year were both co-managed with me. But that's it.
But beyond that, you are also here, I think, to speak about our upcoming Kickstarter campaign.
Yes.
Can you tell us about the fundraising campaign that's starting tomorrow?
Yeah. So tomorrow, something somewhat exciting because it's the first time that we are doing this. And I see Aaron's got it pulled up and I'm just so excited about it because there's a beautiful video that's going to come with the Kickstarter campaign that really just shares the spirit of KBOO in such a beautiful way. And Derek Crooks, who is our AM public affairs and news director, actually shot and edited and produced this video in a week for us, and he just did a beautiful job. So we are trying something a little new. I think folks are very used to our membership drives, and I can talk a little bit more about what that means for membership drives at KBOO, but right now we are wanting to try something that is going to be an online fundraising opportunity. So we are going with Kickstarter, and we are trying to build a city of media makers. And this is going to be a month-long campaign, and so it's going to launch tomorrow morning. So be ready to go and check it out. And really, our desire is to raise.